You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.
Today on our show, we're talking with artist Christian Siepmeier. Christian, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Let's begin with what you're working on now. What are you involved in, or what's happening at the moment?
Well, I mean, first of all, you introduced me as an artist, and that's maybe not quite so correct anymore, even though the boundaries are, I guess, increasingly blurry. I mean, I run a gallery in Berlin since 2008 and haven't really actively produced any artwork since. So,
Well, you're always an artist, really, right? I mean, you're running a gallery. And
yes, I mean, it is definitely it is a gallery that has sort of evolved out of my own artistic practice, if you want, that's for sure. So, you know, I lived in New York and did my MFA at SVA, and then essentially moved back to Berlin in 2008, knowing that what the situation is in Berlin, but haven't lived here for over 10 years prior to that, I just opened a space, and that space is still around, and it's called Exile, and it's been gone from various kind of definitions, if you want, or it defeats kind of any real definition, gallery or not, or artist-run space, or it is, in a sense, it is a gallery, and currently I'm showing an artist called Patrick Panetta from Berlin, whose work is, the show is called House of Cards, and it's essentially a very stripped-down analytical view, or Patrick's view on the pressing issues of commodification or content creation through context, essentially. And then I'm working on the next exhibition right now as well, which is by an older artist who I work with a lot, Nathalie Dupasquier. So the idea is to bridge different generations of artists as well within the gallery. And so Nathalie, for example, she's a founding member of Memphis Design, and we're showing, I'm showing drawings from 1982 to today. So this is kind of what I'm currently.
So let's go back to the beginning of the gallery. Then I'd like to talk more about how the gallery grew in 2008 when you decided to open up a gallery. Mm-hmm. Why open up a gallery, and how did that decision come about?
Yeah, I mean, I moved back to Berlin from New York, and, you know, I haven't lived here in a long time prior to that, so I kind of knew there's nothing really here to do as such, so you have to do something yourself. I mean, it's an open field in a way where you could at the time still more easily than maybe today sort of implicate or express something. And I mean, I just did, essentially. That's really what it was. I just rented a space way too big, actually, by Berlin standards. I rented like 2,000 square foot of space and just I literally just rented it and was like, yeah, let's do it. So a very sort of Anglo-American attitude towards all this, while a lot of friends of mine, artist friends, were not discouraging me, but kind of calling me crazy to do this, because, you know, as it's kind of commonly known, Berlin is quite a center for contemporary art, while at the same time it's also a very tricky place because there's literally like zero interest or really also investment in art here. And then the gallery, I mean, it was called Exile. It still is called Exile. The name has gone through various circles in my head as well. Sometimes I'm okay with it. Sometimes I dislike it. But it's in a way always fitting because it's, regardless of the definition of the gallery, it's always a certain kind of place of fluctuant or unease. That's how I would describe it. So whatever, if I've turned, if the gallery has, if Exile has turned from, let's say, a project space that was quite successful but too much work to really continue on that level, to then having to operate commercially, because what are we going to do? We all have to make a living somehow. It sort of went like through various circles, and it ended up where it is. So Exile does participate in art fairs as well, for example, as maybe a sign of commercialism, but has a slightly still, also the artists I work for with a slightly, let's say, kind of like a certain kind of unease in regards to the contemporary art world and the way it's functioning.
And at this time, you're not teaching or doing other work. The gallery is supporting itself and supporting you?
It is supporting me to a degree, yes, but I'm also teaching at University of Pennsylvania, so in Philadelphia, in the MFA program.
That's a big commute, isn't it?
It's a little bit of a commute. I mean, I'm not teaching on the level that I have to go every week. I'm doing seminars and studio visits and finals. And 2 years ago, I curated the MFA final exhibition, thesis exhibition in Berlin. This year, I'm not curating it, but I'm involved in the programming and the planning of the exhibition, which will be in Brussels in a couple of weeks. And I am back and forth. I also I collaborate with one of the artists I represent, Kazuko Miyamoto. She's 73, and she runs actually the longest and oldest continuously running artist-run space in the Lower East Side, which exists since 1986. And but I'm trying to help run the space by taking over at certain times. So I'm running also about 2 to 3 exhibitions in Berlin, in New York, in the Lower East Side as well. So yeah, it's a lot of traveling.
And then what is the space in the Lower East Side?
It's called Gallery 128. It was opened by Kazuko Miyamoto in 1986 as a squad. Kazuko was the founding member of AIR, or First All Women Art Collective, and her and Anna Mendieta, it's a history that is not very researched at all, which is always very surprising to me how, in fact, really, frankly, little interest there is in the history of AIR in New York, also from institutions, also in regards to the work of Kazuko Miyamoto. There's a lot of interest in her work, finally, through the work we do together in Europe. There is a little bit of interest in her work in the U.S., and there is zero interest in her work within New York. It's rather sad, actually. But she's left there in this space. She left AIR with Anna Mendieta after curating a show called Dialectics of Isolation in 1981, and then both went their ways, and Kazuko opened this space in 1986. And this space has had, actually, her attitude, her approach to art has a very deep and meaningful and lasting influence on how I run Exile today.
Well, it's a very well-known space in New York, of course, that I know. What I'd like to ask you is, because you seem to be in a peculiar position to understand this, I interviewed many artists in Europe, Berlin, all over the world, really, and what I notice is that in Berlin and in Europe in general, there seems to be often a strong critique of, as you were saying in the beginning, commodification, the cruelties of capitalism, this sense of the market that is quite different than what we have here in America. And even at the beginning of our conversation, you seemed almost apologetic about taking a gallery into commercial realms, you know, and that's something that, of course, in America, no one would apologize for. But I understand that there's a different feeling there, and it's fascinating to me because I'm attracted to that. It's always exciting to talk to artists who are pursuing ideas and their work and are not thinking about the market.
But how does that balance out? How do you see the difference? You're dealing with American students, then you're going back to Berlin. Do you see this huge difference in attitude that I'm talking about between America and how, let's say, students or even now early and mid-career artists are pursuing potentially the market, and how artists are doing something quite different in Berlin and other places in Europe?
I'm not so sure if I see. I mean, obviously there's a difference there's a historical difference in approach to all of to this kind of system in Europe or in continental Europe than to Anglo-America. Let's just talk about why the auction houses are in London and in New York. Of course, it's because of these kind of rules that don't exist there. In the artists that I work with, or like that I see also at university, I don't really see so much a continental difference between Europe or the States. I see more a general feeling of you either with it or you're not. For example, what I'm trying to do at UPenn in Philadelphia with the students is, I guess in a classical sense, it's called professional practice, but it's more about like trying to raise the awareness for the situation so that the student is actually, in fact, able to make an educated decision about how and if or not to enter this commodification game or not. I sometimes feel that actually younger artists are more than happy to play that commodification game and don't have a problem with it at all, which is fine. I don't have a problem. No one has a problem with the market, but you can't really have a problem with the market, but it's still... It's a necessity. Art has always been sold, always been bought. I mean, it's always been a luxury product for the sophisticated few. Actually, I only recently read that the Venice Biennale, which essentially one can argue is nothing else than an art fair these days, only in 1968 got rid of its sales office. So in the old days, there was no conflict there. It's only like through 1960s politics and the critical theory that this distinction became clear. So, I mean, I would argue actually the opposite. I was like, let the Venice Biennale open sales pavilion again so we can get over this and finally everyone can realize that it's obvious when, for example, the dealer of a particular artist curates a pavilion in Venice, then these kind of things are obvious. And it's more a question, it's not so much a question of age, I feel, it's a question of position in terms of how far do you want to go with this commodification structure or not.
That's very interesting. So there's really, in a sense, the still thinking and changing about how these two systems work, because I didn't know that about the Venice Biennial, that they ever had a sales office. And essentially,
yeah, I didn't know that either until recently, yeah.
So that's fascinating. But it also operates into what we think of, and perhaps part of the, which is what part of the critical thinking about the market brought about, the so-called nonprofit world and the... in the commercial gallery world and nonprofit worlds have less of a, as I've always understood it, have less of an incentive to commercialize. So you get something which, for lack of a better word, is more pure. For example, you know, museums, the way I used to perceive some museums in New York is that they were more interested in looking at nonprofits in the city. As opposed to furthering the interests of galleries. Now, that's not always the case now, but even with selecting artists for the Venice Biennial, in the United States, there's nonprofits that, as I understand the system or have been told, there's nonprofits that put forward potential artists that could be candidates.
Yeah, I mean,
for the
of course.
Galleries couldn't do that.
I mean, it's of course a very blurry area, and this idea of nonprofits being outside of this is obviously an illusion too. I mean, there are curators of or directors of non-for-profit institutions selecting galleries for art fairs. That's in New York. That's you know, it's not even a critique. It's just something that sometimes I think we should, or also in terms of when I teach with or work with the students, should be brought up. What does that mean? How is this made and how is this constructed, what we see there, and the relationships between museums and galleries and non-for-profits? It's just, if it's becoming so blurry that I feel especially students here and there are kind of unclear about finding their way through this in terms of making an educated decision for themselves about this.
I think you're right, and I'd like to talk about how to make that decision, but I think the lines have become blurred. To me, what's one of the more interesting developments is, I don't know if you've been to Mana Contemporary in Jersey City.
I haven't been yet. It's on my list next time.
But it's a very unusual and in a way kind of bizarre model and different than anything else. It operates looking like what we think of as a nonprofit. There's there isn't a sales office. However, it's run by two people who own a moving company, and essentially it was designed as storage for artists and permanent storage, and that's how they make all their money. And then the exhibitions there, and you probably know this, are curated. Now they're bringing in different curators, but you know, the art world has never seen anything like this, and they're making money, and artists are doing well in their studios there, and there's so much traffic in there. It looks like PS1 MoMA. I mean, tons of people are coming in, and they're business people, so they thought, wow, this is going great. Let's do this in Chicago too. That way, they could simply reproduce this model. So that is certainly blurring the lines.
Yeah, it's. I think it's at the end of the day, what's behind a project like this is it's real estate. In times of crisis, the only places, I mean, at least in Europe or here in Berlin, we can feel that as well. I mean, collectors are buying properties further out and advertising them as studios that they rent for artists that aren't really even available to emerging artists anymore because they're way too expensive. But then these collectors present themselves as if they are sort of, you know, benefactors towards the Berlin art world, and it's just a joke. And at the end of the day, it's real estate, and that's what it is. And you know, the Fondazione Prada, we have maybe similar to Mana Contemporary, actually, Fondazione Prada in Milan just opening, having twice the size of the Whitney. The new Whitney. So, you know, it's just a question what this means and how you can kind of, if we would all stick to a certain kind of honesty and say, like, no, you know, this is what we do, this is what we are, this is what we do, and this is how we influence also the commercial realm, then I think we would all be a lot better off. But it seems almost that even in, like, critique today, when you address issues like that or even talk about them, that you almost like considered, at least it's not very popular to address these kind of potential conflicts of interest.
Absolutely. Well, that's true. And that's why it's refreshing to talk to you about this, very much so, because, you know, again, in all the different people that I talk to, everybody has a different opinion about what's right or what's wrong or what works or what doesn't. And I'm very much sympathetic to how you're seeing it. What do you tell students or what is it that an artist has to evaluate, do you think, to decide whether they're, let's say, an emerging artist or even, you know, early career, mid-career, whether they want to enter into the commercial realm or not, and how to separate that. If that's a fair question, it sounded like that's what you were talking to your students about.
I think that is a fair question. I think it's, first of all, it's a personal question. It's an emotional, personal question you can't predict what is going to happen, but also it's like, are you really the person who, do you want this? are you made for this game? That is, as we all know, increasingly just a glitzy tribe that travels around the planet and meets at various places. Are you willing to, are you okay with this way of operating? It's not even about, it's not even a judgment. It's like, are you able and do you have the skills and the emotional stability to play this game? And also, is the art that you're creating, are you creating art for the circus? That this is something you have to evaluate immediately. Like, obviously, you know, there is a very particular artistic product, let's call it, that is way more adaptable and approachable and sellable and therefore marketable in this context of the commercial realm. And I've noticed that even only in the 5-6 years that I'm doing Exile at art fairs, that the few that I've done, I haven't done very many, but like I've certainly been to a lot as well, and that the level of engagement with the actual object, the artistic object on display, is just simply dropping. Quicker consumption, of course. And if your artwork is not made for quick consumption and or is not made for easy online consumption through Instagram, let's say you're producing something that's not very photographable on Instagram, then you're already having a certain kind of tricky or difficulty, let's say, in how you can kind of position yourself and what you're doing as an artist within this system. So you kind of have to evaluate what you are doing and what you as a person, I think, really feel comfortable and excited about as well. And there are alternatives. Not everyone will ever, of course, become a commercial superstar, and not necessarily everyone wants that, and not everyone should always talk about this as the one and only way of success.
Christian, thank you so much for talking with us today. It's really been a pleasure and quite refreshing for me.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Yale Radio WIBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.